This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Upjohn Institute researcher Michelle Miller Adams discusses the Kalamazoo Promise, its imitators, and President Obama's plan for free community college. But first, in honor of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, we look back at his visit to Western Michigan University in December of 1963. In 2013, WMUK's Erlene McMichael spoke with Western's retired vice president for student affairs, Tom Coyne.
Mr. Thomas Coyne, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You were present at Dr. Martin Luther King's address here at Western Michigan University 4 months after he gave his historic I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C. What was your role here at Western at that time?
At that time, I was the director of alumni relations, and I was the advisor to the senior class. That's a significant thing in terms of its background.
Give me that background.
The background of Dr. King's speech is, I think, sometimes overlooked, and unfortunately overlooked, because he came at a very significant time in world history, U.S. history, not to mention the history of Western Michigan University. In 1963, as the school year began, the senior class was a very active group, much more active than we realized. And I've realized it when I received a phone call one morning from President James W. Miller, asking me why was Governor Ross Barnett of the state of Mississippi being invited to speak at the Western Michigan University campus, which he had just announced. And I said, I didn't know a thing about it. He said, the senior class has apparently invited him. I told the president I'd find out what I could immediately and did. Turned out that the senior class, a very active group of young men and women, led by President Tom Ruschkamp, had decided that they wanted to have significant speakers on the campus. And so they contacted by mail some 30 figures who were in the news. One of those figures in the news, very much in the news, was the voice of the leading face, so to speak, of segregation in the United States, Governor Ross Barnett of Mississippi. He had, in the year previous, tried to deny the enrollment of James Meredith to the University of Mississippi. He was clearly one of the most rabid segregationists in the country. But he was in the news, so the students wanted to hear him speak. And he accepted. Of all the 30 that were sent, he's the only one who accepted. And the president, James Miller, took a great deal of heat, great deal of pressure from local people, the local heads of the NAACP, local government officials, and then up into the state level, including up into Governor Romney's office.
I'm sorry, were you the senior class advisor?
I was the advisor.
But you didn't know that they had done this.
I was blindsided entirely. I was very, very much surprised by this. But the president said, this is a student's invitation. They have the right to hear a speaker on this campus. He will come on according to our regulations, which mean that he will be subject to question and answer period. But I am not going to deny the students the right to bring in a speaker. This is a university. And he saw it as a teachable moment. And so even though he took a tremendous amount of pressure, including threats to cut university funding, lots of anger, he stood by the students, even though he had been blindsided as badly as I had. And as a result, Barnett came and spoke on campus. But because of his speech, a number of our leading faculty members, led by Dr. Sam Clark, who was the founder of the Honors College, wanted to have other speakers on the other dimensions of this whole civil rights issue. And they set up a speaker series called The Conscience of America. And one of the first speakers that they wanted to get, of course, was Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. King accepted, and although the first date that he was supposed to come, he was not able to come, he did arrive in December and did give his speech at the Fieldhouse. Unfortunately for Dr. King, he arrived in the midst of a raging snowstorm, which greatly reduced the attendance. We probably only had about 2,000 people in attendance. And
what's the capacity of the field house?
The capacity of the field house, the way they had it set up at that time, would have been about 5,000. Dr. King came and presented the leading speech in this Conscience of America series. He was, I think, finally the only speaker who did come. But he gave a very measured address. I thought at the time, I think at the time still, that he was very grave, almost somber in his approach. He did not have in his talk the glowing eloquence that he used in the Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech that we hear so much about. And part of that, you know, was because in Washington, he deviated from his regular speech. That was an add-on that he put in at that moment. And I think Dr. King's memorable speeches are when he did that, when he moved into his I am a preacher mode, and he spoke from the heart to the people who were there as a preacher, as a teacher. But at Western, he was more on track, so to speak, more on target. And he was fairly somber. He was really probably more effective even in his question and answer period.
What stands out to you as someone who was there listening to him give this speech?
I remember a couple of things. One, I remember the delight of Sam Clark and President James Miller. They had now someone to speak in contradiction and an explanation of this whole issue of civil rights versus segregation. I remember President Miller's initial comments to the students and to the audience present that the logical course of analysis is action. And Dr. King had been showing that action throughout the country in his efforts for civil rights. And he wanted that to be a lesson that the students would learn as well, that education was a sham unless it was a question of their taking that education and transforming it into an action. I remember Dr. King's very measured comments in response to the questions that he was given afterwards. He was particularly attentive. You could see him thinking clearly, what do I want to respond to this question?
You say that he was very measured in his responses to the questions, but you felt that he did, that it was more impactful, the question and answer period.
Yes.
Tell me what's the content of that you felt was so impactful?
One, his speech was a speech about the conscience of America. So he was trying to give a broad overview. The question that stands out most clearly in my own mind, because it really was prophetic, not only about what he was talking about, but as it turned out, his own life. Dr. King was asked in one of the very last questions, what would be the impact of President Kennedy's death on the movement for civil rights and the civil rights bill? Because President King had been assassinated.
This is just weeks after
Kennedy had been assassinated November. So King made a point of saying, and he had talked to, I presumed on this issue, a number of times with President Johnson, that he thought that it was not unlikely that the movement would, the bill would go ahead and be successful, and that in fact President Kennedy might have been more successful after his death than he was before.
Why is that?
And when you realize it and you look at the impact of Dr. Martin Luther King himself after his assassination and the impact that he had had on a number of individuals who have followed him and who have stepped into his footsteps, you begin to see that he really, although not, I'm sure, consciously, was reflecting his own life.
So would you agree that the movement advanced greater because of the deaths of these two men?
I very definitely do. I think that...
Why do you say that?
I think that President Kennedy, with his assassination, again, achieved an almost mythic stature. But what he was fighting for, and at that time he was fighting for it, President Kennedy moved slowly into the civil rights movement. He did not move rapidly. He was pushed along by men like Harris Wolford and his brother Bobby, brother Teddy. But he was he was conscious of the forthcoming election in 64. He'd had a very narrow election in 60. And so he was moving with a certain amount of political caution that his advisors, Harris and Bobby and Teddy, were not really willing to get. They wanted to move much more quickly, and so did the civil rights leaders. But he was moving. Now he was moving in that direction, and it was known that he was moving in that direction. And as a result, when President Johnson came into office, he immediately took up those challenges and brought them forward in President Kennedy's name. And he was able to do, using Kennedy's example, Kennedy's martyrdom, so to speak, as a way of forcing the American people to say, now we have to rise up and meet the challenge of our dead president.
Thank you, Mr. Coyne, for joining us.
Tom Coyne is retired from Western Michigan University. He spoke with WMUK's Erlene McMichael in 2013.
Sometimes a man does more in his death than he could have ever done in life. And sometimes we must, in history, take an evil situation and wring the good out of it.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. President Obama has proposed a plan to make community college free. The White House says that the program would cost about $60 billion over 10 years, and if all states participated, would include about 9 million students. The idea of free college has been part of education in Kalamazoo now for over 9 years. A Kalamazoo-based researcher says there are many parallels between the Kalamazoo promise and the president's proposal. Michelle Miller-Adams is a research fellow at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo and also a political science professor at Grand Valley State University. She has written extensively about the Kalamazoo Promise. Michelle Miller-Adams, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Gordon. Always happy to be here.
So what are the parallels between what President Obama announced last week, which again is just a proposal right now, is not anywhere near being actual policy, and what has happened in Kalamazoo with Kalamazoo Promise?
So the programs have one key similarity, which is that they seek to bring the financial barriers to going on to post-secondary education down to virtually zero. One of the things that I really appreciate about the president's proposal, and that is similar to what we have here in Kalamazoo, is that the proposal he has made suggests that the grant to support students going on to community college be made on what we call a first dollar basis, which means it would be the first financial aid these students get. That is also the case for the Kalamazoo Promise. Unfortunately, and largely for cost considerations, it is not the way most of the other place-based scholarship programs around the country are structured. And it's important for a fairly subtle reason, but the bottom line is that it's important because it provides the most help to the students who need it most, who are low-income students. Low-income students are also going to qualify for federal financial aid in the form of Pell Grants.
So just to explain this a little more, the idea is with a first dollar scholarship, this money comes before any Pell Grants, and when you apply for Pell Grants, this won't count against you?
Exactly. You would get your federal tuition grant. Well, it would come three quarters from the federal government, one quarter from the state. You would get that first. And then if you were a low-income student who also qualified for Pell Grants, you would be able to add that money on top of that. It would support things like the cost of books, the cost of your computer, and at least a portion of your living costs. And that's crucially important because not having the resources to pay for those things is a barrier that keeps low-income students out of post-secondary education. For a middle-income student, they would get the federal and state tuition grant, but then they would be responsible for paying for their own living costs, their own computer, their own books, and of course, being middle-income, they would be better able to do that. The problem with doing it the other way, which is using a scholarship to close the gap between federal financial aid and the need that a student has, is that perversely, middle-income students get more money than poor students. So if a student is going off to community college under a typical last-dollar scholarship, their Pell Grants will cover the cost and they won't get a scholarship. A middle-income student who does not qualify for Pell Grants would receive the money to pay for their tuition. So first-dollar programs do a much better job of providing more resources to those students who need them more, and that is how the Kalamazoo Promise is structured, and that is also how the President's Plan is structured. Interestingly, it is not how the Tennessee Community College program on which the President's Plan was modeled is structured.
Let me address, though, something that came up in the Washington Post editorial, where they said that this was an ambitious plan, but perhaps not necessarily a wise one. They said, under Mr. Obama's plan, taxpayers would pay even for those who could pay for themselves. If additional money can be found for education, why not direct it to those who face the highest barriers? And you've sort of addressed it, but maybe we can amplify on that a little bit more. Why not direct more of the money, target it specifically for students who would have a tougher time affording it?
Right. So this is the debate that we talk about a lot around place-based scholarship programs between, in fact, around all social programs, between universal programs and targeted programs. Intuitively, it makes sense to take your money and target it where it's needed, in this case, to low-income students who face that financial barrier to go to college. But evidence from Kalamazoo and other universal social programs suggests that there are some very powerful advantages to having social programs delivered to everyone. One of those advantages is that the program is tremendously simple to understand, and there's something in it for everyone. The idea of wanting to make our country a better educated country by facilitating access to post-secondary education and training, you don't really want to amend that by saying, so we're only going to help low-income students get there. It's a much, much more powerful message to say we want everyone to do this. As I mentioned, that first dollar structure means that, in fact, low-income students are going to receive all of the resources they need to do this, whereas middle-income students will still need to support their own living costs, costs of books, other ancillary costs. But universal social programs tend to get much broader political support, much stronger buy-in across the political spectrum than targeted programs do. They have the added advantage of not being stigmatizing because they are for everyone. I hate to bring Europe up, but European countries have some very effective social programs, and they tend to be structured universally. So they have universal high-quality childcare. They don't have programs like Head Start, where only poor kids go, raising all kinds of questions about quality and where resources are going and those kinds of things. These are programs that affect everybody in the society. And as a result, they have very, very strong levels of political support. We've found the same thing in Kalamazoo. This is a universal program. It's for everyone, the Kalamazoo Promise. Good students, bad students, poor students, rich students. And that has made it, in effect, about the whole community. Everybody in Kalamazoo feels that they have a little bit of an investment in making this thing work. And that's what a universal social program can get you that a targeted program does not.
Does this, though, bring us back to one of the things that you have pointed out in the past has made the Kalamazoo Promise quite popular, is that it's privately funded by anonymous donors. So we're not talking about limited public resources being put into this. And for instance, the president's program, if we're talking $60 billion, it's $60 billion used for community college that can't be used for something else. Is that where we start to get into some of the details here about public versus private money?
Yeah, we do. Absolutely. And it's much easier to launch a place-based scholarship program with private money, particularly if you have a small group of wealthy individuals who decide to do it. Many other communities are doing it, and they're doing it with, some of them are doing it with money from individual donors. Many of them are doing it with foundation money, local corporation money, and some of them are even doing it with public money. But I think it's important to look at it in a little bit different way. I know this will sound crazy. $60 billion in the scheme of government spending is not that high, particularly if you look at some of the extremely high expenses that the U.S. government makes, particularly around our military spending. But if we think about this as an investment in our country's future competitiveness and basically the level of skill that our workforce has spread out over time, this is not a huge investment. I'd like to just point out that high school, which we all now accept is compulsory, universal, and publicly funded became so really quite recently. In some states, it was not compulsory to go to high school until well into the 20th century, into the 1940s. So the movement toward universal publicly funded high school, in which Kalamazoo played a really important initial role, we could go into that later if you want, but that was a function of the changing needs of our workforce. Previously, when the U.S. economy was more agrarian and very sort of basic manufacturing, it was okay to go into the workforce with an eighth grade education. Over time, it became clear that workers were going to need more education than eighth grade, and that's when high school spread across the states to become compulsory and universal. I think what the point the president is making and that many, many other people have made is that high school diplomas are no longer sufficient to get you good jobs pretty much across the board. That is not to say that a four-year academic course at a college such as Western Michigan University is required for everyone. Many, many of the high demand jobs in our economy do not require a four-year degree, but they do require more than a high school diploma. They require specialized skills-based training, other kinds of technical training, certification programs, shorter-term programs that are precisely what the community colleges are so good at offering.
You mentioned Kalamazoo's role in sort of the history of making high school the standard, I guess you could mm-hmm. say. I mean, that came back to the question, the Kalamazoo court case, the Kalamazoo school court case, came back to the question of, is this a public good and is it a public need for people to get an education? That's more or less where that court case came down, correct?
Exactly. And this is very analogous. And it's not like the issue is going to be settled immediately, because I don't think anybody expects Congress to, you know, show up next week and pass this proposal. But it's out there. It's now formally in the conversation at the highest national level. Should we, and yes, we should, start providing public resources and making up to two additional years of education universally available for everyone. So it's not really an issue of can it be done privately or should it just be for poor kids? It's really about our economy. It's really about our workforce.
Senator Bob Corker, who is from Tennessee, where the president made this announcement and accompanied him for the event, he praised Tennessee's free community college tuition program, according to the story in The Washington Post. But he said that a big federal program wasn't needed to extend community college to more students. Instead, he said he preferred more tailored state and local efforts. Is there an argument to be made that there would be some differences in what we would need in Michigan as opposed to what might be needed in Tennessee, as opposed to California, as opposed to Florida, and that maybe the states should have a little more say in how the programs get implemented?
I think there is an argument that, and in fact, it is a reality that the states and local governments serve as these laboratories of policy innovation. This is a great example of it. The Kalamazoo Promise has sparked place-based scholarship programs in close to 40 other communities. The Tennessee program is not the only state that is considering making community college free. There's some other efforts going on. So states can be really important policy laboratories. And yes, the needs will differ from state to state. One thing I read that actually really surprised me is that I've always operated on the assumption that Pell Grants that are, you know, around $5,700 right now a year would cover community college tuition in everywhere. Turns out in Vermont, community colleges are $7,000 a year. So that's not true. So there is a wide variation in how community college systems are structured. There's also a wide variation in terms of capacity. In every state, community colleges would need to work hard to respond to the influx of students that a program like this would bring, and also a shift in the type of students. You would have students who are not necessarily ready for college going to college. We see that here in Kalamazoo with the Kalamazoo Promise. The community colleges need to respond. Those responses would be different. Those needs would be different, really almost from community college to community college, but certainly different by state. So I think there is an argument for a lot of state and local input into how these programs are actually implemented. But if it is a national priority to get all of our workforce more skills and training, leaving it up to a very, very slow process of states replicating other states and having that panoply of programs out there that are going to be more effective in some places, less effective in others, more generous in some places, less generous in others, it's not a great way to make policy in response to a national priority.
The Kalamazoo Promise, as you noted, has led to a lot of other communities trying to design their own programs, have more place-based scholarship programs in their communities. What's the status of that right now? How many are out there, and are there more that are even still in the pipeline?
Yes, there are more in the pipeline. We at the Upjohn Institute are working with a handful of communities right now and helping them think through how best to design a program that meets their local need. That is the exciting thing about these place-based scholarship programs, is that they emerge out of the local context, they respond to a local need, they are supported by local assets. And that's a really exciting policy, innovative policy approach. It does not negate the need for public funding for community colleges. It depends on your definition, and it depends how you count them. I've come up with kind of a working definition that reflects, I think, what many of us feel, which is that if you're talking about an effort to increase educational attainment, create a college-going culture in the schools, and also somehow transform your community, if you are a place-based scholarship doing that, trying to do that, I would consider that a promise program that is in some way related to this family, of which the Kalamazoo Promise was essentially the first. And the key point there, there are a lot of scholarship programs that try to increase access to higher education, but the place-based structure gives you that focus on transforming your local community, sparking economic development, increasing community engagement, transforming your district in terms of the norms of college going and the kind of community support for that. So that's what we see. What I have been increasingly concerned about, I am not alone. I work with a whole network of researchers across the country that are looking at the impacts of these promise programs. Many of these programs have been developed, and their structure has been developed with very little attention to evidence about what the program is likely to accomplish. And we also have two quite distinct models emerging. One of them is the universal model that we have here in Kalamazoo, where everyone in the school district who meets this minimum enrollment and residency requirement gets a scholarship to go somewhere, to go to the school that he or she can get into. About half the programs have opted to limit their scholarship program to higher achieving students. A handful have targeted it based on financial need, and that to me is actually fascinating. Why have these college access programs really neglected the dominant model of social policy programs, which is focusing on those who need it? But many of these programs have opted to have a GPA minimum, an attendance percentage minimum that are, you know, really quite high. Many of them require a 2.5 GPA for high school graduation, and a handful of them require a 3.0 GPA. To me, that is not really a transformative program of the type that we see here in Kalamazoo. It's essentially a merit-based scholarship program, of which we have many, but in this case, structured at the level of the school district. And I guess what is of greater concern to me, and what my fellow researchers and I are trying to do, is that sometimes these design decisions are made without really thinking through the impacts and without reference to what we already know about the impact of place-based scholarship programs.
Michelle Miller Adams, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Michelle Miller Adams is a research fellow at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo. She is also a professor of political science at Grand Valley State University. You can hear more, including her reaction to the latest data on the promise, at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.